how it's going to affect electronics, biotechnology, although we'll have to wing that a little bit without Scott Gottlieb, how it's going to affect business models going forward. If everything that has been said so far is true, what we're going to see is a increase in the velocity of business model evolution, which means that startups are going to rise out of nowhere, capture value at a pace that will make Google's capturing of value look slow. But it also means that companies in traditional industries could go down faster than they ever have before. I was thinking not long ago about the effect of Skype. eBay bought Skype and will pay anywhere from $2.5 to $4.1 billion for Skype for voice over IP. We also saw voice over IP coming. Certainly anybody who's attended this conference has been well aware of voice over IP. But it's sort of like one of those things like the internet and the web browser. It takes a big bang like that to get Wall Street's attention. Netscape's IPO in 95 was the big bang of the web browser era. It changed everything in terms of the allocation of capital. And now Skype's acquisition by eBay for an extraordinary amount, I think, is the big bang on Wall Street for voice over IP. But little noticed was that $32 billion of market cap has disappeared out of incumbent telephone companies over the last 12 months as the Skype and Vonage revolution has progressed forward. So I certainly am of the opinion that as pace of business change accelerates, that we're going to see more and more events like that. Well, everybody's here. Nick Credenick is pinch-hitting both for Thomas Lee, the Stanford professor, and for Scott Gottlieb. So you're going to have to be the jack-of-all expertise here. You're going to have to be the one-man personification of the singularity, Nick. But Nick is a semiconductor expert, and you'll hear more from Nick later in the conference. But Nick, we welcome Nick to our panel. David Tenenhaus is the VP of Corporate Technology Group and the Director of Research at Intel. George, you know, Josh, you know, and Ray Kurzweil, you know from last night. So the first question I want to ask, and by the way, I'm going to throw it open for audience questions with about 15 minutes to go, so start thinking of your questions and I'll give you a reminder of that. Josh made a pretty bold assertion about nanotechnology, that it is a break. It is not an evolution from the miniaturization of electronics, but in fact is a break because we're manipulating atoms from the ground up. I would like to hear the panel's opinion on that. Is nanotech an evolution or a clean break, Nick?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, but I think it's really a point of view. I think there certainly is. I divide the world into two pieces as far as nanotech is concerned. One I call big physics, and the other I call little physics. And if the properties of the bulk material determine what the properties are in general, then it's big physics stuff. And if the surface material properties dominate, then it's small physics stuff. And there's a huge gap between those two. We really know how to manipulate materials in the bulk world, in the big physics world, and we know how things operate there. We don't know so much about it in what I'd call the small physics world. And so I think there's a huge gap to get over. There's enormous promise in the small physics world, but we just don't know how to do much there yet.
I'd like to comment on that. I think it's a very different concept, though. Conceptually, it's a break. That new concept will emerge gradually. I showed some charts quickly last night on the increasing number of patents and citations in nanotechnology. But the key issue is being able to define these processes, whether we're talking about biotech or nanotech, as information processes. We're understanding our biology as information processes. That contrasts with the old paradigm where we just happened to discover things that worked, and it was very hit and miss. We would automate that hit and miss process, but we really didn't have models, information process algorithms describing biology. The same thing in nanotech is actually develop computerized information techniques that can manipulate matter and energy and then do them in massively parallel fashion, like 10 to the 23rd operations simultaneously, and really be able to rearrange matter and energy. That's a whole new paradigm. We haven't really done that yet. We've done it in small experiments. When it happens, it will be radically different than anything that's come before. We'll be able to create anything from, you know, extremely inexpensive input materials. I think that revolution is 20 years away. The nanotech that exists today is largely nanomaterials, which actually very often is a hit-and-miss process. We create new materials that have certain surface properties. We don't really have a sufficient information model to predict their properties, and so we discover them. It's the old hit-and-miss paradigm. The real promise of sort of molecular nanomanufacturing is this new paradigm that is a break conceptually, but its emergence will be gradual but exponential.
So information processing is really the break, and nano may be one of the first expressions of that.
Well, we're seeing early harbingers now. I mean, I mentioned last night experiments where people are building tiny devices that are not just surface properties, but are actually little robots and mechanical devices at the molecular level. So that has occurred, and we are applying nanotechnology, at least under 100 nanometer features, to electronics. We're already down to 65, and 50 and 35 nanometer generations are on the drawing board. So there's certainly early harbingers of this revolution.
Isn't a key test case whether these new tools that are coming from companies like Molecular Imprints and ObduCAT and those companies can bypass this second Moore's Law, which is the $2 billion fab increasing to the $10 billion fab on and to the horizons, ultimately rendering Intel as the only company in the world that can produce semiconductors. What are the real prospects? What is the state? You say that Molecular Imprints has the prospect of an IPO next year. What are the grounds for bringing Molecular Imprints? This is printing semiconductors on new substrates. In a very cheap and simple way, resembling a printing press rather than an elaborate 700-layer process of photolithography, soft lithography.
So on the technology side of it, for those that understand e-beam technology, where you have the ability to get ultra-fine features, but it's limited because it's massively slow. People have tried to do this in a very parallel fashion. Economically limited, not necessarily technologically, but you're limited by the amount of time it takes to make a feature. Molecular Imprints basically puts e-beam on steroids and says you can carve out a mask using e-beam, and that mask is kind of now like a pink stamp, maybe from the 15th century, that you would make a wax imprint on. Molecular Imprints.
What's the role of the e-beams here?
The e-beam carves a mask. So it'll carve a mask.
All right. That's it. That's not a change.
That's not a change. So in a sense, Molecular Imprints is probably not the good poster child for this particular conversation because it is changing the economics in a way that you can stop relying on an Olympus or a JEOL machine that costs $40 million inside of an Intel fab and instead use a $4 million machine that allows you to stamp out structures in a massively parallel way without having to rely on e-beam at that first step of making your master. Why would Molecular Imprints go public? They started, 2.5, 3 years ago, doing $250,000 in revenue, selling one tool, $4 million the following year, $8 million, and now $20 million. They've had 3 or 4 years now of consecutive revenue growth at over 100%. The management team, which I think is always critical to any business, particularly for the street, is run by a guy named Norm Schumacher, who, for those in the semiconductor business, knew as one of the heads of MCOR, and just a seasoned veteran, expertly run board and management team. Growing internationally. So.
David, does this have an impact at Intel? Or?
I'm just sitting here kind of enjoying it. I sure hope our competitors are building $10 billion fabs and doing 700 process steps, because that's going to really improve our competitive situation. We're certainly nowhere near those systems.
With what?
Microphone off? Sorry. I was saying I sure hope our competitors are building $10 billion fabs and planning 700 process steps, because we're nowhere near those kind of numbers. We arrested that second law phenomenon many years ago.
But do you see molecular imprints as a threat?
Well, actually, you know, we're their portfolio company. We're engaged with them, so we obviously don't see them as a threat. We see them as having some opportunities to help with certain parts of the manufacturing process. They don't actually, we don't see them in anywhere in the near term helping with what you might consider the high-end part of the process, the expensive part. You know, one of the problems with all of the imprint lithography schemes is you've got this mask, and if you're stamping with the mask, then the mask is getting dirty, right? And if you have to if you can't get a lot of reuse out of that mask and you can't get high throughput, you can't do high volume. And if you have to write the masks with an e-beam, that's a slow process. You know, similarly, by the way, when we do optical processing with masks, we already have a problem that masks get dirty and have to be repaired just from, from debris, et cetera. So, one of the issues here may be, do they help at the high end for people that want to do very low-volume processing as opposed to people that want to do high-volume processing? And, with a different hat, when I sit on Defense Science Board task forces, people like the DOD folks may have a very strong interest in being able to do, essentially high-end chips, but in exquisitely low volume. I'd like to come back. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to expand on Nick's question. IBM embraced the personal computer, but in the end, the IBM personal computer became the first million-unit selling personal computer. But in the end, the corporate immune system rejected it. And when Intel went from the 286 to the 386, the legend has it, apocryphal or not, and I think it's true, is that the 386 was so powerful at the time that it began to threaten mid-range systems at IBM, and IBM choked, and Compaq ran away with the market. And from that point on, IBM never made a penny of profit from the personal computer. Now, Intel consists of really bright people, including yourself, and you see the nanotech revolution coming, and you see different ways of fabricating computation. But you still are the leader in a previous era. And as Clayton Christensen said, it's very, very hard for leaders in a previous era to get on track to the new era. I don't want to let this question go that Nick opened up. Is Nano a friend or a foe of Intel's business model?
So if you look at Nano as a whole as opposed to imprint, I think it's very much a friend. And I think to the extent even that it's a foe, it's good for us, right, to the extent that it challenges us to change our thinking. If we go through some of the different realms that we've been working, let me actually start at the very beginning, which is people. That's kind of fundamental to what a company ends up looking like. I think Josh sort of hinted at this. What's really interesting, I don't think there's a convergence going on so much as a new group of players coming to the table and their learning and knowledge, and it's particularly a set of chemists. And you mentioned sort of Richard Smalley's team with the carbon nanotubes. It's people like Charlie Weber, Paul Alvesado. These folks are actually bringing this really exquisite molecule modeling and processing expertise to the table, and that's getting hybridized with existing knowledge. So at a people level, that's changing us because I now find them going off talking to a different group of people. That's pretty exciting. We're recruiting from their graduate students, bringing them in. So they'll become part of our DNA. If you then kind of roll that out and say, how do we use nanotechnology, I think it will first start in some of the bulk materials. So, and both Josh and Nick kind of hinted at this, new materials with better thermal and adhesive properties, which we'll use. Then over time, we'll start bringing it into things like our interconnect, the way we wire the transistors together, to be able to get new properties there. We'll be able to use some of this wizardry, and particularly the assembly wizardry, to bring new materials to our silicon kind of platform. So all of that is really to the good. And then I think a really exciting part is it opens up a chance for us to jump into new businesses. So, for example, we recently started a digital health group, and part of that is the biotech piece. And that biotech team was previously a research team. A piece of work I'm particularly proud of is some instrumentation work they did on single molecule detection. So, you know, for Intel, it also produces this kind of opportunity because it's going to produce some disconnects in other businesses as well as our own. It gives us a chance to get to some other business areas in the country.
I could relate George's comments, and I think it's key to Chris Anderson's presentation last night. Another major paradigm shift is from centralized to decentralized technology. And chip fabrication, because they have cost many billions for fab facility, have been highly centralized, and therefore require a particular chip that hundreds of millions of people can use. The new paradigm for nanotech, both in electronics and in mechanical systems, will ultimately be highly decentralized. And there are emerging technologies where you basically can produce the electronics that you need on demand, and you can therefore have applications that are niche applications. Microelectronic mechanical systems on the mechanical front is the current state of the art. They tend to use older lithography standards. So if the current state of the art is 65 nanometers, MEMS tend to use maybe 200 or 300 because the way of using those old plants for something useful. But ultimately, when we can move that to decentralized facilities and create electronics or just two-dimensional, ultimately three-dimensional systems that could be used for electronics or mechanical systems, we'll be able to create mechanical systems that are approaching nanotech. That's kind of a whole pathway to get from where we are now. We're now starting to take these MEMS devices off the substrate and create little mechanical systems. It's not quite nanotech because it's 200 or 300 nanometers rather than under 100. But obviously everything is moving down. So 5-6 years from now, there will be under 100 nanometers. We'll be taking the things off the substrate, creating three-dimensional structures that we can get decentralized fabrication facilities for these kinds of mechanisms and chips established. That's a whole route to this sort of golden era of, you know, a tabletop nano assembler.
If you tie together, you know, Nick's original question about information, what Ray was just saying about kind of customized chips, and I think you'll probably talk about FPGAs maybe, and the aspects of this in the market that you see there. There's an analogy that I'd like to invoke, and this goes to the very first thing that Rick said about information being the separating, or information computing power today being the separating factor, the limiting factor of what's making nanotech different. The analogy is 200 years ago, there was a guy, Eli Whitney, who we know is one of the forefathers of the Industrial Revolution. What he did that was so dramatic, living on his farm in upstate New York, was to shift the factors from one that was limited by physical labor, where to make devices, in his case he was manufacturing guns for the U.S. government for war, shifted from a skilled gunsmith to interchangeable parts, where any monkey could come off the street, use his machine to stamp out these gun structures. So he shifted the factor from labor to one that was then relying on physical capital. Today, I think nanotech is able to flip that again, but ride this exponential curve because of information. What I mean by that is, I skipped over this in my talk, but if you go to Phil Kekis at Hewlett Packard, he is designing circuits in real time using molecules, using supercomputers that will take these molecules, let them interconnect in a very messy, highly error-tolerant way. There'll be 4% errors throughout the entire device. And then use the pathways of a supercomputer to actually carve out and design the chip in real time. And he has shifted the factors again from today where semiconductors are limited by the capital equipment, and he's flipping it so that the labor is now the limiting factor, but labor is not a human skilled craftsman, but a cheap supercomputer. So the two have kind of inverted because of the information processing power of today.
The majority of the people in the audience are investors, and we're not here to give specific stock picks. But let's talk about business models. I mean, Ray, you seem to be describing a world that is really going to favor the quick and nimble over size and scale. There were certainly, in the beginning days of the web revolution, everybody was obsessed with size and scale, and that seems to have turned out to be a fallacy of where we're going. Would you agree with that?
I agree, and I thought Chris's presentation last night was very prescient because we will be able to go to sort of mass customization in every aspect of manufacturing. You'll have your body scan and go in and pick out the material and the style you want and then have the clothes to custom manufactured, and we're going to do that for chips. And the key thing is to be able to express processes as information, which is increasingly happening, and ultimately almost everything will be information, and then it can ride this law of accelerating returns that applies to anything having to do with information, where we double the price performance, the capacity, and bandwidth every year. So that's the exciting combination, and you see that in every area, and certainly in TIP.
I'd like to hear everybody on the panel about how this translates to business models that work.
I'm not sure whether I'm going to answer your question or not, but since I started, I'll say something, and that's that I think we're really talking about two different issues here. One is information content or information science, and the other is really physical properties. And so what's happened in the semiconductor business is that now it's the semiconductor business that has paid for all the development that's gotten us to the point where we can now manipulate molecules and atoms. But it's the information content that's important to that business. It's that what we're doing now is coming down in scale until we can finally start to exploit the information content of natural systems, like biological systems. We can start stealing those solutions even by companies like Intel for a standard electronics system. The other part of that business is, or the other aspect of it, is the physical properties themselves, and when can we start exploiting, making materials programmable because we can exploit the quantum confinement properties of the surface molecule. And so that's a very much more difficult problem, in my opinion, and that's where you get this bottom-up view of nanotechnology, I think. Let's start exploiting, building things molecule by molecule. That, I think, we're a lot further from being able to do. You know, we can do bulk materials, we can build instruments, and you can build equipment right now, and there's a market for that. But it's going to be a while before we start actually being able to control single-walled nanotubes and putting them on, you know, where we want them and making them have the properties that we want them to have. So I guess my answer is business as usual in the semiconductor business, except that it's going to get better because we can start exploiting the information content that we can get to now, but there'll be new applications and new materials.
Okay, you're taking an evolutionist perspective, and you're more of a revolutionary. Nick's more conservative than you are.
I thought that we would have philosophical differences, but I agree that with everything you said up to the point where you said that it's much further out, the rational design of material inorganic semiconductors in the case of nanotubes. I will actually agree that carbon nanotubes are a further off prospect than inorganic semiconductors where we've had 30 years of industrial know-how and processing with. But nanofist designs in silico, of which Intel is a co-investor with us in the company, designs in silico material that they have predictive, you can have this function, this color, this optical effect, this electronic resistance, so forth, and then we'll actually manufacture it chemically. And it will be 100%
key. And what kind of volume, though? I mean, you know, I can believe people can do this in the lab and do these magical things. And it, I mean, it looks great. But how soon can you turn out, you know, 200 million a year of whatever those fuel cells are?
Well, part of the beauty of this, and where I think it changes the economics of manufacturing, is that you don't need large volumes of these materials. You can use very, very small volumes, whether it's of these tetrapod solar cells. Essentially, you know, this,
but you can make money doing that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this bottle would be the equivalent maybe of about 1,000 square feet of the solar material that Matsushita is manufacturing.
So I think I'd just draw the line a little differently. And maybe I'm sorry, I've got a little shortage of voice here, so I'll hold the microphone. Which is, you know, there's one step, which is exquisitely designing the individual molecule using computational and other techniques, modeling, et cetera. And I actually do think we're there. And I think that companies like Nanosys, but many others also, will essentially become material suppliers. I mean, you kind of indicated it, right? They'll produce the bottle or the vat of having of material containing a large number of similar molecules, all of which were exquisitely, you know, they say exquisitely designed one, and then they mass produced it. Okay. Now, you get into a very different state when you start going, you know, Nick actually said something more subtle, which is the precision location. And so it's this issue of, okay, now what about when I'm combining multiple molecules? And now I've designed each molecule very precisely and exquisitely, and I'm precisely assembling. That's another much tougher step. Now, we do a little bit of this today in a sort of surface way. So, for example, when we do atomic layer deposition in the semiconductor industry, you're kind of doing that, but you're putting a whole layer on. So you're doing it layer by layer, but only in one dimension, not in three dimensions. Getting to two and three dimensions, I think we're still quite a ways off, but that will be really neat stuff. And I think that really will make a big change. Now you're really controlling the position of every molecule and their interrelationships. It's a computationally much more interesting problem to model, and it's going to be much, much harder to control the assembly. So that's the one that I think we're much further away
from. And I do think we're 15 to 20 years away from three-dimensional electronics and mechanical systems, but there are a lot of...
it'll be cool.
It'll be cool, but there's a lot of actually exciting applications of 2D. If we captured a little industry like the energy industry, the $2 trillion
industry?
Energy. If we captured 1% of 1% of the sunlight that falls on the Earth, we could meet the 13 terawatt energy requirements we have in the world. And then, so we could do that ultimately with solar panels and fuel cells, neither of which are really three-dimensional. There are fuel cells now being built with MEMS, which are essentially two-dimensional. They use the third dimension of the slight height of the chip to get larger surface area. There's exciting developments in that. There are exciting developments in nanotech, at least under 100 nanometer feature size solar panels that will be efficient, lightweight, inexpensive. Solar panels today don't have any of those properties, which is why they haven't really caught on. I think in 10 years you'll see significant penetration by these kinds of developments, and Josh is following a number of these companies.
Josh has raised timeline accord with yours.
I'm a little bit more aggressive. This is, I mean, we've obviously both put our money where our mouth is, but these companies have struck deals both with Intel and Kodak and Matsushita and others. What Ray was just describing about solar cells, this is a solar cell that I'm holding, which is semi-transparent. It has some reflective cover. And in the first quarter of 2006, as I indicated in my speech, it was rolled out in all new building materials produced by Matsushita, the parent company. The interesting thing about this that people could lament is say, well, this is less efficient than the traditional solar cell that you would put on a roof. You know, it's a piece of plastic, in a sense. A normal piece of glass is made with a glass, a sticky polymer, another pane of glass, either two-pane glass. Take out the structural polymer in the middle and put this functional polymer, and you've got a working solar cell. So while it's less efficient, maybe it's getting 8 or 10% efficiency rather than 12, 15 plus, the cost to manufacture this, which is essentially solution-based, is so dramatically low that this is approaching a dollar per watt in energy production. That's where the key differentiation comes from. Similarly, the argument, which I would agree with about Ray, said two-dimensional computing is something that's happening today on planar substrates like plastic, which cannot be done today in an Intel state-of-the-art facility, Intel, again, being an investor in this company, Nanosys, that we can produce transistors more accurately, in this case, which is not a partnership with Intel or Kodak, but with the CIA, for phased array antennas, where you can eliminate the big moving satellites that look and press for a signal and put the transistors and phase on a piece of material that is being used today by the Army to essentially replace what costs $1 million per square foot on an Aegis destroyer ship with something that costs hundreds of dollars per square foot on a piece of plastic. And then you can think about the ripple effects that people like Tyco and EDC and home security would care about home monitoring, where your wallpaper is able to give in three-dimension real-time imaging of every aspect of your home and send that back using information from the Internet to a central repository.
The cheap sounds like the perfect definition of a Clayton Christensen disruptive technology, doesn't it, George?
It does.
Maybe we should open up for audience questions now, so fire your hands away. And we've got Richard Vigilante here. Why don't you just shout it out before we get there?
We got a microphone for you here.
Identified last night is rational design. I mean, that's the break that's hypothesized. And it's obviously crucial to nanotechnology, particularly in Nick's example of building up individual molecules and precise placement, because you wouldn't do that precise placement unless you already had a rational idea of where to do it. Now, rational design would be an enormous break in human history, because economic development
has always been associated with surprise. I mean, arguably, the very structure of capitalism, as argued by our host, by Schumpeter, by other great economists of the entrepreneur, suggests that the essential structure of capitalism is its ability to move funding to regions of surprise. And now we're actually, it sounds like we're talking about abolishing surprise in economic development. That would just be an enormous break in human history, and I'm wondering whether we need to consider the past where surprise drove economic development as just an aberration, an expression of the limitation of our powers, or is it more fundamental than that, and therefore, does this break deserve some skepticism?
Anybody chime in? I see Nick. John.
I have one. I mean, it seems to me that this audience represents 0% of the population that understands something about what's coming, and so you're talking about it will be a big surprise to the Days of Our Lives crowd.
There's also a surprise. There's also a surprise in market acceptance. First of all, our simulations and models aren't perfect, so they still have to be tested outside of the simulator, and so there's surprises there. And then there's surprises as to what gets adopted and at what rate. I find it surprising, but I've been surprised by this for 20 years, how remarkably predictable the measures, like price performance and capacity and amount of knowledge and so on, is of these different information technologies despite the chaos and unpredictability of markets and individual standards and so on. But, you know, which applications will be successful, whether it's Skype or iPods, is surprising, and there'll continue to be these kind of market surprises, and that's what drives this forward.
I think it's about planned development, right? And heretofore, we have always thought planned development is a kind of failed paradigm. And now you're talking about planned invention, in which essentially we know where we're going before we get there. That is completely new.
There is a distinction between planned development in an engineering sense and in an economic sense. So, what Ray is talking about, and I think your analogy yesterday of, you know, kind of thermodynamic, temperature-based, you know, you can't look at an individual molecule, you can't look at an individual company, you can't look at an individual technology and make a prediction, but you can predict over, you know, the average of that, of the properties that exhibit, whether it's temperature, whether it's a market, whether it's a linearity or an exponential curve. But I think that the aspect of surprises, there will always be breakthroughs, there will always be inventions, there will always be actions and discoveries in science and technology that will drive that. And if this wasn't a market that was driven by surprises, I think we reflected in prices. From the private equity standpoint, the venture deals that we're doing, prices are way low, way suppressed, which means that either people are discounting the field that we're investing in, or, you know, they don't have the expectation that we do to pay the prices. If everybody did believe this, then people would be pouring in the prices would be high. It wouldn't be a surprise.
Our egos are getting away with us here, from us here. You know, we've been doing rational design for quite a long time, right? I mean, Newton captured stuff in the Principia. You know, the Greeks captured some fundamentals that triggered rational design. We've been working with genetics for over 100 years. You know, Schrodinger's equation. There's nothing new in nanotech that wasn't captured in Schrodinger's equation. So let's get realistic here. This is, you know, we're treading, you know, really on the shoulders of giants. What we have, I think, that's new is the computational capabilities to do the modeling in much, much more detail than in the past. But, you know, this is just the next step from that point of view, and it's not nearly as big as some of the steps that have come before in history. It does enable some exquisitely new, you know, wonderful new materials, and I think the surprise will come from the application. I have to agree, energy. Boy, and it's not just going to be about solar. I think there's a gazillion ways these materials can reinvent the energy industry. So the surprise, and what I love about the United States in particular, to be just a little parochial, is its ability to bring science to new applications. I think the surprise will come from the wonderful applications and business models.
Just to address surprise, and the question that came up earlier, evolution versus revolution. I showed a graph yesterday how, you know, from a linear perspective, and that is the perspective of most people, because that's how we experience the world, the Internet was a surprise in the mid-1990s. It just came out of nowhere. But it, in fact, was a trend that started 15 years earlier, that was just progressing. But if you have a gradual evolutionary trend that's exponential and it gets into the C part of the exponential, it feels pretty revolutionary.
Well, what George comment on the question?
Carver sums it up. The more we know, we don't discover that the world closes down. It opens up. Each new discovery opens up new possibilities and new degrees of freedom. There's no rational planned economy that emerges from the nano world, which is still full of baffling enigmas and challenges of every kind. I think we have more possibilities and more need for surprise than ever.
Wayne Tom, Rich, forgive it if this sounds like a dumb question that's playing my ignorance, but I'm sitting here listening to this new materials, and we're obviously talking about economics and creating things that could be surprises. Do any of you know of the possibility that alchemy could be going on out there, and can any of you see someone actually making gold, for example, and marketing it and using it?
Yeah, people are making diamonds today. I mean, it's a new diamond technology that can actually make gem quality diamonds.
Do you see gold coming?
Well, I think gold is probably a different story, but exactly right. There's something called a Apollo diamond, which is making quote unquote synthetic diamonds. The cartels in South Africa are trying to label it as such. Take it to a jeweler, if you take it to somebody that is a trained expert in the field, it is completely indistinguishable from something that is, you know, again, based on scale of operations, somebody that's got big mining operations, that have the recipe to actually put that capital equipment to work to manufacture and train it down.
Setting new elements probably will eventually be feasible. It's not on anybody's drawing board. This actually goes beyond nanotechnology, because nanotechnology is manipulating molecular fragments to create complex molecular structures that can do electronic and mechanical tasks, not manipulating electrons and nucleuses to create a new element. I mean, that technology probably will come along, but there's a lot we can do with molecular nanotechnology.
Brett, what about biology? It seems that we've talked quite a bit about electronics and material science, all very interesting stuff. Maybe the fact that we haven't talked a lot about nanobio suggests we're a little further off than some believe. This gets to the next point about small physics. You know, Richard Jones in his good book, Soft Machines, talks about the very important forces of Brownian motion and viscosity at the nanobio scale that maybe that, you know, don't necessarily fit with an overly mechanical view where Eric Drexler came from over the last 20 years. Where are we really in even beginning to understand, let alone master, some of these forces of the cell that could lead to real nanobio?
I disagree with the premise that we haven't made much progress in biology and that's further out. It's actually much closer in the golden age of nanotechnology. We now have, we're still in an early stage, but we have developing models and simulations of the information processes underlying biology, and we have a whole new range of tools that allow us to reprogram biology. I mentioned a few last night. RNA interference just emerged 2 years ago, but it really appears to be a way of turning genes off, and we have identified quite a few genes we'd like to turn off because they promote things like heart disease or obesity. We have emerging new methods of gene therapy that can reliably place the genetic information in the right place and basically add new genes or modify genes. We have means of turning enzymes off or adding enzymes. We have models of, for example, atherosclerosis, of the seven stages it goes through and the information processes in each one, and a whole range of tools that can attack that process at different vulnerable stages. And the majority of the drugs in development now are not drug discovery. They really are based on simulations and the sort of rational design of drugs. I mean, the drug development process is, you know, 5 to 10 years, and these things are in the pipeline now. Some are already in the testing pipeline. I mentioned processing speed, which basically destroys a key enzyme that's critical to the progression of atherosclerosis. And the phase 2 trial showed it stopped atherosclerosis, and Pfizer's spending $1 billion in the phase 3 trial. So that's pretty advanced. That could come out in a couple of years. So biotechnology really is rational design based on, you know, real theories of the information processes underlying biology. We're in an early stage of that. We just finished 2 years ago collecting the genome, and we're still in the process of reverse engineering it to understand it. We understand a few hundred of the 23,000 genes. So this is going to be a very fruitful area. That's another $2 trillion industry. But it really will be revolutionary in terms of overcoming disease and ultimately aging processes. And the golden age, in my view, of biotechnology will be 10 or 15 years from now. The golden age of the 3D, three-dimensional nanotechnology, nanomanufacturing is further off. It's probably 15 or 20 years. 5 years makes a big difference in this accelerating time.
You have a combination of both bio influencing information technology, as I described a little bit in Cambrios. You're actually using biologically mediated ways of assembling, which is the way that we assemble ourselves and nails and hair, to actually grow and assemble latticeworks of electronic semiconductors. And then David mentioned Intel, which is a semiconductor company, thinking about forays into biology for diagnostics, detection, single molecule detection sensors. Ray talked last night about an underwear company that is able to detect certain analytes and diagnostics.
That's my company.
And your underwear.
Get in the bio. I think the diagnostic space is phenomenal. So at Intel, I like to think we're doing physics, chemistry, and computation in service of biology when we come to these spaces. It's not that we're biologists, but we can bring exquisite detection with wonderful computation. So for example, if you have the exquisite detection, you can do diagnostics. We can then add our machine vision to improve the signal-to-noise from diagnostics. We can then add machine learning to correlate the diagnostic results across the whole population to tell you where you fit in. So those are, I think, phenomenal medical opportunities. From a science point of view, an engineering point of view, something I think is really exciting is people are just starting to get to work on synthetic biology. Now, we have been engineering pathways in organisms for quite some time, but the interesting sort of needed science in synthetic biology is actually stabilizing organisms. And one of the problems we have with bioorganisms is they evolve. That's a good thing because they evolve in response to environmental pressures, and that's why we exist. But if we actually want to deliver a product, people don't want the product evolving while it's in use. So we're going to have to develop actually ways of limiting and constraining biology so that we can really engineer it. And I think that new field of synthetic biology is going to be really quite exciting. It's just getting going.
And Nick, and then George, and then we'll have to end the panel.
Okay, actually, I just had a question for Josh. In your presentation, you showed a chart that showed how the valuations of the nanotech startups were declining precipitously, or at least they were declining. And then you showed lots of opportunities in nanotech. And then you showed a pie chart that showed that venture firms are contributing about 0% of the investment. Why is that?
Maybe some of those things weren't clear, but I'll parse them out. The valuations weren't just nanotechnology companies, but private companies in general. The Series A round, the first real institutional round of
still a bargain.
Yeah, of a company, 5 years ago at the peak of the boom was $17 million. Today we're doing a Series A or C deal spun out of the university at a 1.5 pre-money valuation. We'll put in $500,000, and the company's valued at a $2 million valuation. It'll hit a series of milestones, and then you can see a 5, 10x appreciation. The venture money total, over the past 4 years has been about $1 billion. And as I predict, I think 90% of that capital will disappear and people will lose their shirts. And, there's always going to be a power law of a handful of companies that capture most of the value, most of the capital. And those companies have not done down rounds. They've done successive up rounds. And all metrics that you would measure a company's growth, like growth of employees, revenue, close to EBITDA profitability, are all growing positively. I would say that the metrics all look very positive.
Well, I mean, they may look positive for the companies that people have invested in. My question and sort of my complaint is the venture community, which is supposed to be leading this whole mess, is contributing approximately 0% of the research investment.
That's not really true, is it?
If you say last year $250 to $300 million of venture money went into the sector, right, so you have to parse this out over time, that's commercializing technology that yielded government investment or benefited from government investment 5 years ago. The government investment that's going in today will not yield commercially viable products for another 5 years. There's a lagging cycle between when venture investors come in to assume non-scientific risk. Right? We don't want to fund a science project. We want to take management risk, people risk, technology risk, market risk. The science risk is left to the domain of basic science and taxpayers.
So you want to be 2% of whatever pie chart you're talking about. You just want 90% of the profit, but 2% of the risk.
No, I don't think that's a fair characterization at all. Over time, you're going to see that change. Just like, you know, 5 years ago, the government accounted for 100% of investment. Today, it's about 40% with corporations doing 40%, ventures doing 2%.
Yeah.
And I think over time that will change more and more, where you're going to see the venture piece of the pie expand, the corporate piece of the pie expand, the pie as a whole get larger with the government staying fixed.
And Nick, what's wrong with that?
That's the history, by the way, of the internet, of telecommunications, of the rail. I mean, every industry has benefited from initial impetus of government money to fund the basic science and then hand it off to capitalists to assume the
rest. You were quite confident in saying we'd see a Netscape-like IPO in the next 12 months. What makes you, that's really throwing a dart and hitting a number. What makes you think that?
Well, I think it's a combination. One is the inefficiencies in the capital markets on the venture side. You've got thousands of venture firms funding wireless deals and telecom deals and optics stuff that's very heavily saturated, which means that by definition most of these companies are not going to see the same returns. You have a smaller number of quote-unquote nanotech companies that are receiving a disproportionate amount of funding from a smaller amount of VCs. I think the opportunity is much larger there. And then I think you have a situation, just human psychology, people are always looking for the next new thing, and there's always going to be some allocation of capital that will shift and reallocate from sector to sector. And I think people are saying, look, you know, we've got our investments, and now, you know, the whole internet thing has played out, and we've got Amazon and eBay and Google and Yahoo, and we've got our telecom companies, and we've got our telecom companies. What are going to be these next advanced materials or nanotech companies? And that's where people are putting their bets.
We're about 10 minutes over, so we could go on for a long time. As you can tell, the IQs of every panelist, the moderator accepted, can boil water. So if you want to talk with our panelists further during the breaks, please do. But in the interest of time, let's give the panelists a hand and move on to the next.
If you'll join me in welcoming Jay Adelson, founder and CTO of Equinox.
Thank you. You guys hear me okay? Equinix, by the way, but well, good morning, everybody. Mind if we talk about the internet for a few minutes? And nanotechnology is really cool, don't get me wrong. So how many of you saw my presentation last year? Just going to show a hand here. So about half of you? I think it's the right thing to do when you're wrong about something. Just stand up on a stage and tell everyone that you're wrong and you're sorry, and I was wrong, but I've never been happier about being wrong about something than I was last year, and we'll get to that in a minute. All right, so last year I put this thing up. The finance people and legal staff at Equinix are terrified of me. They are terrified. I guess it's maybe I say things I'm not supposed to say, or I just go off. So this year, not only do I put this up here, but they actually sent someone here to watch me. Jason is in the audience over there. He's armed with a tranquilizer dart. So if I grab my neck and I fall down, whatever I just said, don't trade on it, okay? All right, so... Since a lot of you know what Equinix is, I thought I'd keep that pretty brief today and talk about 2005 on the internet and then sort of my thoughts about 2006. But just in the interest of time, rather than go through a lot of Equinix numbers, I thought I'd take you on a real quick tour of what Equinix is in the data center, and then I'd move on to last year. Let's do that. All right, so while this is going, what you're seeing here is a simulation, an animation of a fly-through of what it's like inside of an Equinix facility. So what Equinix does is we build these airports for the internet. So if you're on AOL and you send an email to somebody on Earthlink, we're the place where AOL and Earthlink touch. We're the literally the international airports for internet traffic. We have about 1.4 million square feet of data center space serving this purpose all over the world. And now, the good news is, you know, while sometimes it's not as sexy to be on the back end of the internet, you get to watch like what Chris talked about last night, but in the long tail, all these cool new companies showing up and doing their thing, inside your building, you don't get to necessarily play yourself so much. But it's a very secure business. So, on that note, so Equinix are these hubs, and we get to see from an interesting vantage point who's connecting to who, how much bandwidth they're sending, and I was also delighted to see Ray last night confirm once again, year after year, we're doubling our internet traffic. That's good, right? I mean, we want to see traffic continue to increase. But there's some confusion, I think, over some terminology out in the industry, out in the media, and I want to clear it up now while you're driving through an IBX. How many of you heard the story about Google building a network? Raise your hand. Okay. So last year I talked about content peering. Content peering says, okay, you're Google, and you want to get your site to as many users as possible. So what you do is you connect to SBC, or you connect to Verizon, or you connect to Comcast, and you make the distance between your content to those users extremely short. You increase performance, you don't pay for it, you get it for free. These are good things, because obviously networking costs are important to content companies, particularly emerging content companies. But there is a problem that I didn't mention last year. The problem is that if you're SBC, you're incurring some costs to move that data, let's say from Los Angeles to New York. So before I let you touch my network for free, Google, I want you to share that cost with me. And that is the origin of why these content companies are building networks. It's not some confusing, we're building an alternative internet. What good is an alternative internet to Google if no one's on it? No one could get to Google. That wouldn't work too well. So the idea here is that a company like Google builds a big network, now can qualify for that free connection to companies like SBC and Verizon and reduce their networking costs and increase their performance. Now, once you have this backbone, you then hopefully have some research scientist in your company that says, well, what can we do with it besides just this thing we do for peering? Like maybe we can do voice or Wi-Fi or whatever. But it's not an alternative internet. It is the same network that Microsoft built. It is the same network that Yahoo built. And every large content company that comes into these Equinix centers can fit that bill. Skip ahead. All right, so who are these guys who are now on the 2005 landscape? Who are the players that are buying? Now, one of the interesting trends, I think, as we look back in 2005, is the identities of the companies who were doing network-based applications and thought it was important to locate at the core of the internet or in data centers or outsource in general to any data center started to change. So it wasn't just Yahoo and Google and Microsoft anymore. It was financial institutions. It was government, I mean, NASA and the Securities Exchange Commission, options clearinghouses. All of these types of businesses started to find an interesting advantage in being at a hub or outsourced to another data center company. There's lots of factors that I'll get into why outsourcing was good for them, but I think that explains why when you look across the data center industry in general, and Equinix in specific, you see this massive uptick in enterprise business versus just the traditional internet business. So what we saw was that more than half of our revenue came from existing customers. Now, why that's important is that there's a bit of a filtering mechanism, and all the bad ideas are sort of filtered out to some degree on the internet. What you have is a lot of really good ideas that are growing in their space. Companies as big as Google end up building their own data centers. They're so large that it doesn't make sense. It would be like having an airport with just one airline. Not very efficient. But they continue to use Equinix as a place to connect to all the other networks, which is, I think, very valuable to us. Financial, government, but really exciting to me is digital media. When I look across all those cages of equipment, of racks, of gear, what I see is this there's also sort of a reemergence of the ASP model, which is exciting. Things like Salesforce and others have taken a big dominant role in the acquisition of space in 2005. We saw, just from the financial and government sector alone in the last 18 months, a doubling from 10 to 20 million in our revenue, which I think is a strong indicator that they're outsourcing. And remember, these are companies that traditionally have never put their equipment outside their own closet. I'll get into some reasons why. So outsourcing network applications, big driver, talked about it last year, saw the realization of that in more sort of behind-the-internet applications being staged inside of the Equinix location. All right, so here's where I was wrong. Okay, last year I talked about content peering and content providers bypassing the traditional telcos and the whole sort of, you know, value chain changing. And that did happen to some degree. A company like Google is now has an easier time becoming a network service provider than a company like SBC becoming a Google. There's this low barrier of entry for someone to hook up with Broadwing or something and build their own backbone and use it for whatever services they want. The technologies exist. It's very easy for someone to produce a telecommunications company or a voice service provider, Google Talk, with very little infrastructure. So all that came true, but I was extrapolating on that and said, well, bandwidth pricing has been dropping. I was correlating it to long distance and the value of the network dropping. I was wrong, and I'm very glad I was wrong. If we look at 2003 to 2004, what we saw was, you know, somewhere around $5 a meg to $15 a meg for, this is transit, this is connections to the internet on a wholesale or a commercial level. Really, that hasn't changed. So what happened was bandwidth hit the floor and bounced. So going into 2006, I think, based on the limited supply, you're going to start seeing increasing supply. I think this is very important, obviously, to a lot of you who are following the telecommunications sector. The one thing that has changed a bit, as you can see there, is the spot market. By spot market, I mean we have this new type of business that's being conducted in data centers around the world where I only engage for basically a 30-day term with no commitment. 30-day term means that, okay, after 30 days, I can go ahead and change my provider to provider Y. And the price for that used to be $1,000 a meg years and years ago. Now, as you can see, it's $18. So that's important. We've created this new world where content companies can change. It creates great competition. But the most important message here, bandwidth has, basically pricing has hit the floor. That's good news. Now, in terms of utilization, I mentioned the internet is doubling still. That creates some interesting opportunities in terms of equipment. Equinix, for example, had to move to 10 gigabit Ethernet at the core. Last year when I was talking, we were a giggy, you know, company. We had giggy switches. We used the foundry switches. We're now using the Force 10 equipment to basically handle the density and the speed necessary at the core. This is some fun stuff. All right, I have to switch gears a little bit, stop talking about bandwidth, talk about power. Power is, by and large, any data center company, any person from any data center company, whether they're a hosting company, an exchange point like us in the world, or a private enterprise, this is their number one issue on their mind is power and how to deal with it. If you look at just the statistics on power density and what's been happening in terms of just the equipment that is available today, I'm not talking about 5 years from now. I'm not talking about announcements and new fabrication facilities. I'm talking about right now. A blade server that you buy from Hewlett-Packard or IBM is consuming 14 kilowatts of power. Now, if you look across 2003, what you see is that 25% of the inventory of data center space out there, and mind you, this is data center space that was relatively, even with the supposed data center glut, which I'll get into in a minute, 25% of that inventory was designed for 1.5 kilowatts per cabinet, per one rack of gear. And that's what they were designed to handle. And as you can see, most of the data centers fell into that capacity. Even the new data centers that were built were sub 4 kilowatts. All right? Now, if you look at the guidance in 03 from Gartner, where you just skip that and you just move into what's basically the blade. blade servers are using today, we have a problem. Okay? The industry built these data centers back in the beginning of this century, thinking that they were building these high-density power solutions. They cannot absorb the equipment. Equinix has some pretty high-density power. We can absorb some of this stuff, but I think the bottom line is we had this situation where an enterprise goes and gets sold from some vendor this beautiful piece of gear with all these great properties. They may pay top dollar for it, whatever. And then they go to install it in their closet, in their machine room for their business, and they realize they can't turn the thing on. Not because they don't have the power. Maybe they called up, PG&E and they installed some new power, but because if they turn the thing on, the entire building would melt and burn down. Because it's not just about power, like what the actual capacity is, it's about the heat that is generated by the equipment. That's where data centers fall down a lot, their ability to handle that. So, if you take a look at how data centers react to this, if I've got 4 cabinets of capacity today, and you buy one of those cabinets, like a real estate type deal, and you take up all of my cooling and power capacity of those other 3, I got to raise prices somewhere. Right? Now, I can't really raise the price of the rack because there's this market, it's real estate, whatever, data center space. I can't do that too much. So what I have to do is I have to shift that to charging for power. Very important change in this industry. So if you want to survive and you've got some data center asset out there, you better be thinking about charging for power as your primary source of revenue. Because if you don't, then essentially you're going to be, running out of inventory before you hit your projection. No way to get around that. I saw some great press releases from Intel. Thank goodness, finally, I'm getting this feedback, like they're listening. For the longest time, you'd call up a vendor, and they'd say, well, the enterprises are demanding higher density equipment. I'm like, well, what exactly do they need? Why does it need to be higher density? Do they have less space, and they need to do more computing power? Or is it that they just need the efficiency or whatever? There's a lot of value to blade servers. But I was just curious where the power was coming from. And 1 year later, they found they couldn't absorb these products out in the market. So Intel, thank goodness, 65-nanometer logic manufacturing process for power chips. I've heard that I think today there was a press release, or yesterday, about the Xeon chip. Anybody read that? Yeah, so I mean, basically now we're seeing lower power chips. Thank goodness, we might be able to get around this in a few years. And then the companies that ignored the blade hype and hysteria, telecommunications companies, hosting companies, whatever, who installed one rack full of, 1U boxes, the old-style pizza, we used to call them pizza boxes, right? They ended up surviving this little problem because their efficiency of being able to do that was such that they actually spent less money per watt consumed in terms of the capital that they outlaid to build the rack. All right, so blade chassis still unabsorbable. Where do they go? I don't know. All right, so on that note, real estate. Equinix keeps running out of space and then having to add more. We added six locations in the last year or so, 18 months. When you do that today, you don't go raise $1 billion, or whatever we raised, $950 million over the course of our existence, and build it yourself. You go try and find somebody's data center from the supposed data center glut, and you improve it, and you move in. For $10 or $20 million, you make an investment. There were a short list of buildings that fit that criteria. And about 2 years ago, we started looking, and we got them. Those are the 6. There are no more. That's a problem in the industry. Companies like Internet, Savvis, and others who really need data center space are going to have to go back to the drawing board and build. Now, the difference is we have these new groups like Digital Realty Trust, companies that have gotten into the data center business, who will outlay the capital and then obviously lease back to us, the data center companies, to make this possible. And now when they build these things, they think about fiber, and they think about proximity to the hub or the core of the Internet. Good stuff. All right, that's pretty much it. So in conclusion, what this means is, basic economics, right? There's less supply. there's increased demand, prices are going to go up next year. I think that's a great story. Outsourcing, first time ever, good stuff on outsourcing. And then finally, who these players are who are emerging in the space. We talked about digital media. I cannot believe there's a feeding frenzy on Sand Hill right now. All these little ideas that are getting funded, that their first installation, instead of being one rack of gear, are 50 racks of gear. What is in those racks? Rich media. That's a very important change. I think it's a good time. It feels like a new boom.
I don't know if everybody heard my question or not, but I'm asking sure. about Google and their supposed network that they're buying up, and whether or not that really will bypass, circumvent Ethernet.
Right. So, again, you know, I think that the point here is that content companies need their bits to move from one part of the country to another, one part of the world to another. And the question is whether they outsource that movement of those bits to a telecommunications company that you might know, or if they built their own infrastructure on dark fiber or wavelength. You look historically, Yahoo, Microsoft, and others, they built their own networks because it was cheaper for them to do that themselves than it was to outsource that. All right? That's what Google did. Now, once you have that network in place, it doesn't have anything to do with bypassing Equinix. Right? You're using that to connect the Equinix locations or your strategic locations together. The ramifications of a network that big is that you have this capacity. What are you going to do with that capacity? Maybe you know, if you look at the graph of utilization on a typical IP network for public internet, there's lots of valleys that you'd like to fill in. And so you obviously try and leverage that bandwidth, either resell it to others. Yahoo's talked about that over the years. Or possibly even introduce your own network service. It's easier for Google to become a network service provider than it is for an FCC to become a Google.
Other questions? George Gilder. You say that internet traffic is currently doubling. Is this U.S. internet traffic, or does this include the expansion of the internet in China and Korea and Japan and all over the rest of the world where they're expanding their connectivity to homes and offices at a tremendous pace, you know, going from ADSL to VDSL2 and, you know, all that. Around the world, internet traffic should be more than doubling every year, at least
right.
by that index.
Right, and you know, the difficulty with measuring internet is that now the internet has become so regional in nature. So typically, historically, when it was more U.S.-centric, I could say, well, all the traffic passing between the networks, I measured that traffic, not the traffic that stayed on net, but whatever went from one network to the other network. And I added all that up. So, I mean, Andrew and Lizko would do that figure. You'd end up with a terabit of traffic last year or whatever it is this year. The issue is that doesn't represent internet usage. If I took all the users of the internet and I added up what they were consuming, it'd be a very different number than the inter-network traffic or the inter-regional traffic. And there's very low visibility into that. So, yes, within Asia-Pacific, Equinix has locations in Hong Kong and Singapore and Tokyo and so on. We see this massive amount of content being served. But it's really hard to just add that to, you know, sort of a combined total and say that the entire Internet is growing at some number. Does that make sense?
Not really, but anyway.
It's not easy to correlate, but I also see that if you look at Europe, just as another example, don't forget how significant doubling of traffic in within each year. So that does absorb a lot of that growth that you're talking about.
Thank you. Thanks, Jay. We're going to have a chance to ask Jay more questions in just a few minutes. But first, we're very fortunate to have with us a frequent Telecosm presenter, and that is David Huber, the founder, the chairman and CEO of Broadwing. He's going to continue this conversation about what's happening out on the network. We also have a bonus. The chief technology officer of Broadwing, Mike Jones, is also going to join us. And after David Huber speaks, we're going to have time for questions today as well. David Huber. As I was saying, David Huber.
Thank you. We had a little delayed cue there, but we are here. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be able to visit with you here at the Gilder Forbes Conference again and talk about what's happening on the wireline fiber optic communication space, and how optical networks are evolving and how they affect all of us. I think we're very happy to hear Jay talk about the stabilization of price and also the continued robust growth here on the Internet. I might also add that as a carrier, we see the same type of robust growth on the private line business for enterprise. So large enterprises in particular continue to consume more and more bandwidth of applications and grows dramatically. I don't know about you, but I'm a very enthusiastic user of broadband media. I'm not sure why anyone that enjoys music would consume their music in any other way than through broadband, because ease of organization, the breadth of the library, it's just a great way to go. I look forward to the time when there are a couple of companies out there who are offering movies the same way. That becomes ubiquitous as well. We see a lot of growth, but even within our own company. We use the video conferencing. We're a company that has locations all across the United States, and we use that video conferencing to help tie us together and help to improve our communication. I think that clearly the population centers continue to be major points of data growth. However, you have access into a core backbone at any location in the world, and you can get low-cost access there. But clearly, large NFL cities in the United States and large population centers drive the growth. But what we do see increasingly in our network is companies that outsource the low cost of labor, technical support can be obtained in the Asian, European bloc, Eastern European blocs are used more and more. We're happy, again, going back to Jay's comment there, stabilization in the pricing for Internet services. I think that's important for us, for the others. Right now, the country is embarking on a massive experiment in terms of the remonopolization of telecom networks, and I think you watch the airline industry, the companies that have genetics tied in monopolistic thinking are going to find it very difficult to change that type of thinking, but we'll
see what happens here with this experiment. Hopefully the decisions that are made here in the next few months will be beneficial for consumers and for business. Well, as you know, my first company, Ciena, and then at Corvus, really the leaders in optical technology. I think one of the things that is a bit of a surprise to me and then probably to the markets was the absorption of the technology. I think that in very large carriers who could use the optical technology to lower their costs, be more agile and flexible, I think that the social and the labor unions there really made that a very difficult choice for them and a choice that they chose not to tackle immediately. But clearly at Broadwing we have demonstrated for all the wireline companies we have more revenue per employee than any wireline company. In an industry where scale is important, I think that's quite a demonstration of the technology. We're the only wireline company of our size that's been able to demonstrate revenue growth, improve margins in very difficult markets during the past few years. Broadwing continues to operate the world's only all optical long distance core network. It's been running now for 4.5, almost 5 years, I guess, and found that network operates very reliably and efficiently. There was a debate back when we were developing this technology. By some folks at AT&T that optical networks would never work, but what we found, number one, they do work, they are extremely reliable, and during these hurricanes that have hit our network, continue to operate. We didn't lose any of our networks during either of these outages. Some of the carriers that use traditional networks had massive outages that are actually supporting more traditional larger networks while they get their network put back together. I think right now, as far as core networks, the global standards clearly have been in place a number of years with the FDH and SONET standards. Those work very well, and we continue to see those standards serving us well. What we're seeing now is more standardization on the user side through the converged network or Cisco. Very successful in pushing the MPLS family technology and name. So we see that those standards starting to be very pervasive. And of course, the user side, the real standard that's really out there and continues to gain traction all the time is Ethernet. That's very key in keeping interface costs low. That's another thing that we have seen in the carrier business. Which has been a pleasant surprise to us during the last 8-9 months, is enterprises taking more and more optical services. The gigabit Ethernet fiber connectivity up to the OC48 and OC192 connectivity, which has been quite a change from what we saw a few months back. We'll see, of course, Intel is here. Intel is involved. Driver with WiMAX. Obviously, they've got a couple of agendas there, one to move cell phone traffic over to their technology base, but also to broaden the availability of broadband in the wireless arena. Those prices continue to drop and the investments are made. That could be another very notable change in the internet and broadband connectivity. At Broadwing, we see a big change in this issue of global networks, triple play of voice, data, and video over the converged platform. And we believe that the choices that have been made there provide us some leadership in the area to be able to do true converged services. A lot of networks still are keeping together separate networks for video, voice, and data. And one of the reasons that we were able to make the transition to the converged network sooner in more advanced states than other carriers has been our all-optical network because of that ability to use the core to flexibly connect the nodes of our network. We're able to put together a converged platform very quickly that integrated the core and our access technology. That is one of our key differentiators in our Layer 2 and Layer 3 product, ability to have true quality of service, common platform for all three of these services. Very unique, particularly in North America. The access technology, we're able to use any of the existing access technologies and bring it into our converged core in a very efficient fashion. Today, customers are more and more demanding privacy and security. Large corporations, as they become more sophisticated in their internal IT needs and demands, are looking very strongly at Layer 2 because of the threat of piracy and electronic fraud that continues to grow. And I think, personally, it's a big concern for me. It really changes the way I use the Internet. For corporations, it's very key because of the industry that's growing to commit fraud and to steal money through electronic means. We also see a greater demand for third-party services that deal with the security issue. A lot of technologies out there, we use those technologies, leverage our all-optical core, as I've noted before. Again, cost is very key. But what we see, particularly with this, on the consumer side with the digital media, you see the cost of bandwidth dropping. You see these new applications opening up because, for example, the one that's really there is music. The bandwidth that's available on the cable, DSL, telecoms, fiber networks is more than sufficient for audio. You see those applications moving now that the bandwidth is out there to support it. The MPLS is becoming more and more of a common denominator. We're working in partnerships with carriers, particularly outside the United States, where MPLS is perhaps a little bit more advanced. In Asia and in Europe, standard protocols are really driving connectivity for enterprises and also for carriers. Metcalf, I don't know if he's here. He has oftentimes at these conferences, but it must be very satisfying to him to see what's happened with Ethernet and the same power that this protocol has enjoyed. Gigabit fiber Ethernet applications really driving our business. And the key there is this very low-cost interface, which made it open up these applications that were too high-priced before. Customers like it because they understand it. They work with it in the IT departments at all levels of the company to integrate it very smoothly. It provides a very high cost, a very, very good value. Performance versus cost is better than other technologies that are out there. Of course, it's, even with the VoIP that's taking place today in the future, Ethernet is used to integrate VoIP services, generally speaking. I think we're just seeing today what we call the early adopter graphic or type of business. Some folks understand what it means and jump on it, and after a period of time, the rest of the world comes along. But I think we'll see more and more people that choose MPLS and integrate. Once they have the infrastructure in place, common network inside their own business, very simply see video, voice, or data off of that. And that's very important. I think we'll see more and more video conferencing integrated within businesses. Until now, I think it's been quite cost prohibitive. But with VoIP, that becomes more than just voice. It becomes video phone and video networking will see. convergence is talked about. So again, Cisco has been very successful in selling this. They've been so successful that a lot of times enterprise customers know that they want convergence, but they're not sure why they want it. So definitely see that oftentimes. But I think simply put, it's just to be able to put these three services, voice, data, and video, on a single pipe. I noted earlier, the voice infrastructure that with the consumer market, I think the draw there, of course, is lower cost, but for enterprise, the cost of voice communication is already very low, and really businesses are not looking for a lower price if they end up with lower quality, which consumer voice can be lower quality to start off with. But the promise of voice and video communication is really the added features. For me, this is one that's very important because I know that in my own personal life as a consumer, very few companies, credit card companies, the airline companies, airlines are starting to use it now. They've been forced into it because of their cash flow issues, but they use integrated voice response. But credit card companies, any consumer organization, doesn't do the best job of integrating voice response with the customer. I think what we'll really see with voice is really to integrate sophisticated software, artificial intelligence, really to really expand the markets there. And I think there's a great opportunity there to really take a lead in integrating integrated voice response with a voice platform that can help businesses serve their customers more effectively. The thing that really irritates me is you call up a company that you're buying services from, and they want your account number, whether it's your credit card number or phone company or phone number, and then it seems like inevitably they lose that, and I get very irritated. You know, why did you make me enter that or say that number if your computer systems were not able to keep that number in front of you? What's the point? So hopefully the next few years we'll see some real sophistication around the technology base. I think MPLS is converged network is really a platform to make real progress there. And we've been very happy at Broadwing with our MPLS platform. We're ahead of other carriers in terms of our functionality as a layer 2 and layer 3 platform. Well, I think as a practical matter, what I've been attempting to do here is just talk about the ability to have a, really, I think in an enterprise it means for the lower bandwidth applications, just have a single Ethernet cable. That single Ethernet cable can be plugged into the desktop or into some appliance on the desktop and be able to provide voice, video, and data with that single pipe, whereas the way it's been up till now, you're going to need a separate video connection, a separate data connection, a separate voice connection. I think as a practical matter, that's what it means. The actual standard, I'd like to speak more to this, but the actual standard is evolving, and I think it's positioned very expertly now so that as the technology changes, the name can absorb whatever it migrates to. So success is guaranteed by the way the standards have been set up. There, now it's working. Go back a little bit in history. If you remember what MPLS originally was, is a method, if you will, to make IP do something it was never designed to do, and that is to perform deterministically. So after a number of years where people kept trying to get routers to do things they were never designed to do with varying degrees of success, the next intellectual level was to say, you know, MPLS concept is not a bad concept, just doesn't have the bricks underneath it to make it work properly. But if you take it down to the frame layer, switching trains instead of individual train cars, it works just fine. And you can get individual circuits mapped into individual VPNs, and you can get two QoS. And so what we have embraced in Broadwing is a platform that allows the layer
just built a layer underneath that that packet layer to allow it to behave as though it was deterministic, even though it's not.
And I think the model that we have used to develop our converged network is one that others have not used. It's really been the, what we've done is we've taken our optical layer, which is very flexible and efficient transport, put the newest MPLS or converged switching machine immediately on that optical layer, and we're agnostic as to what type of actual access we bring into that. And then because the new machines can handle voice, video, or data, we're able to have a truly converged network. Other carriers have basically gone out on the edge and put the newest machines on the edge and then tried to patch the services to the core network through various means. And that's run into trouble because the intermediate layer doesn't always carry voice and video on the same infrastructure. This is the Broadwing network, very large network that covers effectively all of the population of the United States. Couple of states up there in the north that don't serve it. We have gotten some very nice press from some of the trade magazines out there that have recognized our progressive MPLS solution and our ability to get layer two and layer three services out there that have true quality service, very high service metrics today. The value to the enterprise customer is really that, that single cable for the less demanding bandwidth and even quite demanding applications, that single Ethernet cable for some of the larger financial institutions that have a different network structure where they deliver optical services directly to their large data needs. Simplifies network management, the tools they have, and with the Cisco or other competing products they have in-house, able to integrate those very, very simply. And just once you have a common platform, then single pipe, you can, if part of your business wants to upgrade, you can do that. The rest of it can stay the way it is. I think I noted earlier that one of the biggest demands we see right now are more sophisticated large enterprises. They want the layer two connectivity. So that gives them an isolation from the public internet and the ability to control multiple locations as though they were the same physical location, or just to expand their IP throughout their entire global network. I think we're getting close to the amount of time that we've been allocated here. You see a lot of drive on MPLS. Customers are demanding it. I mentioned earlier that we see, particularly for the international carriers, they're looking to Broadwing because our ability to provide layer two and layer three with quality of service, they're looking to integrate with us because of our advanced functionality. That's very important for global infrastructure. Thank you very much.
Effects that we were talking about last year on various networks, it was
on the post-production process in Hollywood and managed to capture that market almost entirely. Meanwhile, nobody knew anything about it. So suddenly the telecommunications companies start going in trying to sell these guys, and lo and behold, there's a successful telecom business in Hollywood selling for post-production editing time. So on the same level, to enterprise, for enterprise purposes, like what we used to talk about in terms of VPN, high security, low latency networks are not something that is a commodity, and it's not something that just your traditional telecom companies have sold as their base product. Those are what you hear about, not so much about the successes that Broadwing's had.
So how does Broadwing stay in this position, say, 5 years from now? What happens when, let's say, the post-merger behemoth, they begin offering layer 2 VPN? How does Broadwing use its all optical network to stay ahead of the pack with that progressive vision?
Well, I think the overall key is to keep that vision and to be flexible, but we are, surprising to me, but we're quite happy that we still command the lead with our all optical platform, which gives us that flexibility. And I think the there's a couple other folks who have made announcements. We don't think that some of the announcements were really true, because one of the announcements was indicating
who's this.
I won't speak to the names, but one company announced an all optical network with two single unconnected lines that were like this in the geography of the U.S. I don't think that was really an all optical network, although it was announced to be. Another company announced that they had built one, but they continued to buy large amounts of bandwidth from us in terms of lit services, so I don't think that they've actually completed it. And another company that announced that their vendor doesn't have the product, so we continue to enjoy a commanding lead there, I think. But I think our innovation here that Mike Jones and Mike Bortz both participated in our Converge network was, we built our Converge network inside out compared to the others, where we put the MPLS boxes that could actually run a Converge network, voice, video, and data. We put those immediately on the all-optical core and just fed them with access from any type of technology. Now we have MPLS, where if you put those MPLS boxes at the edge, don't have a way for them to get to the core on a single infrastructure, then you really haven't built an MPLS network. We just really think it makes more sense to switch in the core and route at the edge. And that's a little bit of backward thinking. I mean, you go back to the 50s, and the IBM folks that did a lot of the intellectual capital around how you do data communication would agree with that. And it got a little upside down with the ascendancy of routers, and now it's going back to where it should be. You switch in the core, you route at the edge. And another way of putting it, the engineers would say, is, switch when you can and route when you must. And, just to your other point, we thought at the beginning of this century that we had a 6-month to 18-month leadership position. And our view was that we would get there with technology leadership. We would stay there with flexible products and spectacular customer service. It turns out that lead time has stretched out to 5 years or more in making effective use of the all-optical core to enable other service layers and increasingly integrated service layers. Is there anything? We certainly don't have a deity-given right to maintain technological leadership, but we're doing okay so far.
To what extent is the rest of the industry going in the wrong direction? I mean, Cisco is proposing these super routers which incorporate all kinds of levels of security within them and actually making the network more complex and moving away from the all-optical paradigm. Isn't that happening widely in the industry, that your competitors are actually abandoning the all-optical paradigm and incorporating more specific services and in the...
I think on the core, all of our major competitors have announced intentions to build the all-optical core. And I think in the case of some of them, CFO vetoed that because they'd rather pay down debt than be an attractive merger partner. But I think that they see that they should build the all-optical core, although, if you get down to the it's elegant technology and it's low cost, but the benefits of the all optical network are really cost benefits, and this is the business and final end of it. And because of those social and labor issues, they haven't tackled it. But I think we will see more sophisticated electronic products. It's going to be very hard for electronics to comport with switching in the core. So we'll see, but maybe we'll be wrong like Jay. But we still think that that routing is best done at the edge and switching in the core.
So we would also who's going to build these all if all the other companies are going to do all optical switching? Who's going to build these all optical switches? You had a company that did that, and now it's focused on supplying or maintaining your own all-optical endowment.
So what did the RAND Corporation say in the late 50s? It built all the computers it's ever going to need. You know, obviously, there was a surplus of capacity, a hype that led up to the bust. But, you know, back to your original point, you know, we don't view Cisco's a valued supplier to us. They're not a competitor. And we do think that the sophisticated addition value-added things belong on the edge of the network.
Right.
And as those come out and become more sophisticated, then we'll be a user of those moving them on to our customers.
No, but they want to put these big super routers are supposed to be in the core of the network, not on the edge of the network. They want to route in the core and switch in the edge. That's their whole model.
They want to route when they can.
So they'd like to sell a lot of routers. And
right.
Power to
well,
Cisco's very successful, so I'm sure they'll continue to be that. I think the optical technologies are extremely rich, and what we were able to demonstrate during the time when there was demand for that in the marketplace was that the optical technologies are very capable of competing even with the behemoth Intel that we have here today. But I think that we'll see that competition come back to life as the demand continues to grow. And, you know, to me, you know, my background is in the area of optical switching and optical transport, but things that can be done today, it's possible today to get the type of control over core optical networks that we have with radio frequency technology. But you haven't seen us doing that because it's very, very difficult to see the business models to do it. So I guess my prediction is that once we see the bandwidth demand come back, you will see that type of technology come back because sophistication is definitely possible. The technology has changed over the last 7 years to allow that.
And who's building these networks has changed. We talked about Google and companies like that. Understand that these companies, as they're emerging, they are very focused on separating the layers and maintaining control and quality over the individual layers. And when they buy a converged product, a router with all these wonderful functions, they often only use one part of the function. And if you look across Equinix, you know, in the actual case, you might see lots of fancy high-power boxes, but if you look at how they're configured, right, they're leaving the control to, you know, a various levels of sophistication to the service providers and software. And they're focusing on layer three themselves, which I think says that there's a lot of boxes being sold that have way too much functionality than it's actually good.
Are there any questions in the audience?
Thank you. As Stephen Sprague from Wave Systems, as the capacity of the network bandwidth grows, then the issues of quality of service in many aspects start to pass thresholds where I really no longer care in the past. You know, and as I move forward, because the service falls underneath that threshold where the lowest quality of service meets all the demands that I have. So it'd be interesting to understand, as you talked a little bit about quality of service and also about security, how you view moving to application-level security where I really don't care what's in the network. Just give me bits and give me lots of very high-quality, fast bits. So two questions. When do you see a cloud where I can just plug in and it gives me the quality of service that meets the basic demands for, let's call it video, media, VoIP? And secondly, the impact of having application-level security really separate from the whole concept of VPN?
I'd like to at least take a stab at that first. It's interesting to me because for a number of years, Broadwing pretty much ignored the whole MPLS landscape. We believe that you engineer networks versus engineering traffic, and if you engineer the network right, you don't need MPLS. And that was a compelling story. We had a non-blocking, non-losing IP network. But what we found is that works very well in the core, but as you move further and further out to the edge, and I'm not talking about a hypothetical future world in which there are no blocks whatsoever, but as you move closer and closer to the edge, you do have blocking. You have a fundamental collision-based degrade performance technology ubiquitous in the LAN, and you need to figure out if you're going to support applications that require differing classes of service. You know, for example, voice is very delay intolerant, but increasingly noise tolerant. Anybody with a cell phone knows that, whereas data tends to be exactly the opposite. You need to be able to manage those things. Because fundamentally it is more efficient to switch trains than it is to switch individual cars, we believe that that's best done at layer 2, and if you do it right at layer 2, it'll look like it's being done at layer 3. So do you need differing quality QoS, at least for the foreseeable future? Sure you do, because you have LANs and you have narrow pipes at the edge. Do you need it in the core as much? No.
I think certainly the economic realities of the marketplace, customers, a lot of them are very price sensitive, and if they can get by with a lower quality of service, they want that. Those applications that have to have the higher quality that pay the extra cost.
I'm Doug Walkie with Gigabeam. A question is, how much business are you leaving on the table because you don't have big pipes at the edge?
Well, I think the answer to that is a lot of business. The issue that the industry is facing here with this dramatic experiment with demonopolizing most of telecom in the United States is just very simple. The access issue is just a huge financial issue. And so that ability to get low-cost access into businesses and consumers is a huge problem. I hope that the Justice Department is able to understand that, that they should do something there to make the playing field level and provide a real competitive force. I mean, one of the things that happened in 96 when the partial deregulation of telecom was that I think there's no question that in the U.S., the consumer businesses have benefited dramatically from lower costs and better telecommunications. And so that's obviously an issue in a much larger company. We didn't have to fight that on a daily basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, George.
Getting more bands. These networks and to provide better services will be the focus of our next session and several other sessions as we proceed, including Doug's Gigabeam concept. So thank you. Thank you, Jay. Oh, we got to get this photograph. Rich, you keep on top of me so I know the schedule. Yeah. Well, here we have the man, John Chaffee, who has delivered more bandwidth at the edge probably than anybody else in the world. He is the inventor of discrete multi-tone DSL and has since developed all sorts of broadband over copper and and new hybrid technologies that make it possible to really transform this network. And is also as a new company that is a SIA. We got this wrong in the first newsletter, so I wanted to make sure that can radically change the whole broadband landscape. John Chaffee.
Thank you, George, for the opportunity to speak, and thanks to all of you for your attention today. As George mentioned, I'm with Stanford, which I hope you'll all have heard of. ASSIA is a small company. Started a couple of years ago that's trying to promote some Stanford technologies. And worked with a lot of the major phone companies, started by me and a couple of SBC former executives, Ross Ireland and Wiley Edgeite, and a number of former students at Stanford. So with that small commercial, I'll proceed with the technology. We're going to be talking about what's called dynamic signal or spectrum management, DSM for short, which is an area in the DSL space that's attempting to increase pretty dramatically the speed that the average customer will get out of a DSL circuit. So what I hope to accomplish here today with you is hopefully to give you an idea of what the future of DSL is in terms of bandwidth, what might be achieved as that whole area progresses. There we go. Now, if we were to actually look at the effort or the cost, if you will, that's involved in DSL today, there's a lot of activity on trying to make the cost of modems and equipment very small. But if you actually looked at the percentage, it depends on the phone company and where in the world. The majority of the expense is in their operations to support DSL, maybe 60-70%, even more of the cost is buried there. And if one were to look at that area and how do you automate the maintenance and what would the effect be? I'm pressing the button here, but I'm not getting any. Ah, there we go, finally. The operations is the majority of the DSL effort, and there are a number of different areas, which are quite interesting to look at technically, that could be improved and could either improve the DSL speeds or equivalently reduce that operational cost segment substantially. In particular, reducing so-called maintenance truck rolls and such that dominate the cost of DSL service providing today. So DSM is automated maintenance. Now you can think about, we talk about cable hogs in the broadband industry. Well, DSL also has a similar type of problem. We could call it DSL hogging, if you will. And the first step in this area of DSM, if you think of a cable of telephone wires all carrying DSL signals, they basically radiate. It's almost like wireless. They all affect one another, and they pull each other's data rates down. If one is polite in the use of their spectrum, so each line, say, using the minimum amount of power to achieve a given data rate, that can be improved. So the first step that I hope to take away is just being polite. What can happen if one does that? And then secondly, especially as mentioned just a few months ago about the kind of remonopolization of the telco industry in the United States, certainly possible with high-speed systems to actually have a cooperation between the different DSL signals and what could be achieved in that second step. And as you might guess, being polite leads to a certain level of improvement. Being cooperative leads to an even larger level of improvement. So I'm going to talk about that two steps here today. That first step is kind of the politeness, and the second step is the coordination. Now, if we were to look at kind of a system diagram of a DSL network today, increasingly there are fiber-fed remote terminals or line terminals that get closer to the customer. Shorter phone lines means higher speeds. You can also have existing customers that are fed out of the central office. It may not be very easy to move existing customers over to fiber-fed terminals simply because that takes them out of service. It can take them out of service for as long as a day or a week, depending on the phone company. So often they're left, if they're happy. And what you get is combinations of service to different customers, different speeds. both incumbents and competitive exchange providers could use kind of an information or maintenance type of system that would accept data from the lines, process that data, and actually decide the data rates that get used on the individual lines. Kind of an interesting process to define, and the thought here is how much better could we do, both in terms of the politeness and the cooperation. Fortunately, there's a long delay on pressing the button here for the new slide to come up. Now, this is about as technical as I'll try to get here in terms of the concepts, but if one looked at a simple example of just two phone lines, okay, bound together inside a binder of telephone wires, you could plot the data rate of, let's say, one short line versus a long line. One is much shorter than the other. So as you might expect, if you're to plot the data rates that you can get from the two, the short line can get much higher data rates than the long line can. But they're not independent. If they were independent, you'd get a nice rectangle of all the possible pairs of data rates. And each particular data rate combination corresponds to different use of spectrum. And they're not necessarily independent. If you can adapt this, either being polite or being cooperative, you get a much larger region. If, on the other hand, you try to statically impose a set of rules, either via the FCC or being standard, you will get a much smaller set of data rates that are achievable. This is one of the first key steps. Just starting to be used in DSL, that can improve on the data rates. Now, here's a particular example. You can see some short lines fed by a fiber. This was work that was actually done along with Telcordia. And there are about a mile-long short loop and then about a three-mile long loop. This is a classic situation, fiber going into the network. And what happens is, if these wind up in the same binder, and they often do, the data rate of the long loop goes down because you have a really high energy signal that couples in, and it can actually be larger than the DSL signal coming from the central office, and so it kills it. So this line here, in this particular situation, will probably run at about 300 kilobits per second, which is a low speed. If, on the other hand, you actually ask this shorter line here, which could probably run at 10 megabits per second. Let's suppose we run it at 1.5 megabits per second, but we hold its power to the minimum that's necessary for good service at that speed. And what you get here, this is a rate region plot, just like the one on the previous slide, but actually for an actual experiment. And what happens is we're plotting the data rates of the short and a long line here, and you can see that both can get 1.5 megabits per second instead of 300 kilobits per second. So that's a pretty dramatic jump. That's a factor of 5 increase in the speed of the longer line. This problem is classic as DSL is deployed around the world. Now, what can you do if you take that to its limit instead of just two lines? Suppose we were to actually offer symmetric service. Nobody really quite does that in DSL today. It's asymmetric. But and why don't they do that? Because of the interference between the lines. By making it asymmetric, as in most DSL today, there's less crosstalk or less interference between the lines. But suppose we were to push this to the point where we let everyone be symmetric, but we had all of the lines being polite. What I've plotted here is basically kind of a worst case of data rate versus loop length, where all the lines, the 25 of them in a binder table, were all active, all transmitting at the same data rate, and this is the length, this is the data rate that can be achieved. This down here, this lower green curve, is when they're not polite. And this is the present state of affairs in the network operation today. If they're polite, for instance, looking at 10 megabits per second, which could be a kind of Ethernet speed-like service, symmetric, we'll go 5,000 feet or 1 mile. Now, there's no way you'll see that kind of performance today, but if politeness were imposed everywhere, that is certainly feasible. Let me give you an example. This is actually a GUI interface from... Okay. All right. So what I have here is a GUI interface for a large North American carrier. And what we're going to have here on the left-hand side is the data rates that they get and the data rates if they use this kind of politeness. Each of the lines here is increasingly longer. So at the left are the shortest lines, at the right are the longest lines. The last seven we basically reset and supply them from a fiber-fed terminal. Typically what happens with DSL service in this carrier is they increase the speed each day. They start at a low speed, and then they see if it's safe to go up to the next speed. They'll tell you to wait for a week before you call in and complain about the speed of your service. So what we're going to do is impose the politeness on the right-hand side and use the current provisioning method on the left-hand side for this situation. And hopefully, you can see this jumping a little better. Data rates kind of going up together, but as we start to stress the system more and more, what happens is data rates on the polite system on all lines are higher. So even though they're being polite, one would think, well, that one has to give, the whole collection of loops is doing better. And eventually, we get much higher speed. The longest loop here is in clearly in this position here. This is actually an 18,000-foot loop, which is beyond the normal range of offered service. But even that one winds up doing better with the DSM techniques on the right. So there's quite a bit to be gained just in being polite here as this particular situation shows. Now, why don't they use politeness everywhere in the network today? What I've done is I've disguised the manufacturers' names here, but these are the five largest manufacturers of DSL modems in the world, CPE modems, and we looked at all five of them. And we have a little plot here versus loop length of something called the extra margin of noise that they need. A factor of 10 on this means that you have 10 times the protection that you need. You can increase the noise by a factor of 10 before you take the link down. 20 means it's a logarithmic scale, so you can increase by 100 the amount of noise. And 30 means it's increased by 1,000. Now, what you can see here is on all of these modem manufacturing types, all the way out to 2 miles, they're all doing very, very high margins. They don't need to do that. And in fact, the service provider, in this case, asks them all to do no more than 16. So they're all actually out of compliance with the standard where they're asked to do that. So it's ubiquitous. Why do they do that? Well, when somebody tests their modem in a lab, it looks like it works better. Because if they impose the politeness, the measured margin against noises will look less. It's impossible with a lot of these modems to force them to basically go back and be polite. Now, there may be other ways around that to fix the problem, to impose the politeness through other mechanisms, but it gives you an idea of the situation in DSL today. About 80 to 90% of the lines are hogging, so to speak. Now, this particular area was the first part here, the politeness. Another problem that shows up that can be managed automatically is so-called impulse noise. What is impulse noise? Well, that is, in your side of your house, you have all kinds of electronic appliances, and they can be turned on or off. Dimmer switches on lighters on lights are a great example, and they create noises that couple into the DSL service. And typically, when the phone company comes out to your house to fix your DSL service, they're trying to protect you from yourself. They're trying to put in splitter circuits, move things around so that this noise is not getting into the system. That noise can pretty significantly reduce the performance of the network. Now, based on some work that we did with France Telecom here, we actually had about 30,000 impulses and that were measured all out in their network. What we looked at was basically what kind of delay. Classic way to fix a burst of noise is to delay everything in your receiver, to kind of mix it up and unmix it at the receiver, distribute your noise so that it doesn't hurt you in a burst altogether, but gets distributed in time. That takes delay. Basically, what this plot says is there are ways to fix this problem, even for the worst impulses, with only 5 milliseconds of delay to the DSL circuit. What that turns out to be is a very good number for almost any kind of traffic, whether it's data, voice, or video that's being transported. Now, how do you actually do this in a system? You remember we had some kind of server on the left earlier. Well, what can be done is the level of impulse noise can be monitored on the line. There are parameters there that give you an idea of that. And we can change adaptively rather than having it be its default that ships in all modems, the particular codes that are used to keep the latency low and to solve the impulse problem. When you do that, you're going to get more of your customers working even in difficult environments. Today, they use a default setting for this. And here's an example. The example I like to use the most, and this is because I can make it public because I own the data, is my own home. I have two DSL services. One is from a fiber-fed terminal, and one from the central office. Thanks to SBC, they let me run these experiments on my own house. What my first line is actually 18,000 feet. It's longer than any other phone service that's allowed at SBC. Typically, they cut it off at 16,000 feet, but they let me put the DSL service in. And what we did, basically, this is a plot of some of the characteristics that are recorded from a special modem that we put on my line so that we could see what was going on. And I had this impulse noise. It's actually one of my neighbors. It's not my own home, so I couldn't fix it that way. And we changed the code setting. And when SBC originally gave me the service, it would not operate at any speed higher than 192 kilobits per second. By changing these code parameters, I'm up to 768 kilobits per second. Now, in my particular neighborhood, there's another 30 or 40 customers that all get DSL from that same central office. Every one of them is closer than I am, and nobody gets more than 384 kilobits per second. So in this particular case, you got four times the data rate. Now, my other line, a little later, I took a new fiber-fed service on a second phone line, and it had a different set of characteristics, again, plotting for the system. This one is 8,000 feet away from the remote terminal, so not nearly as far. They're both in the same binder. And here, again, I was sensing my neighbor's noise because I'm in that same binder. And when SBC originally sold me the service, they said it could not run it at more than 1.5 megabits per second. So that's what they sold to me. Today, it's running at 6. Basically, I'm the only customer, residential customer in SBC territory running at 6 megabits as a special service, but we changed the code parameters, kind of a unique profile that was set up for this particular case. So on both of my lines, I got four times the data rate that they originally told me that I'd be able to get. Here's an example, another GUI interface with this impulse problem. This particular phone company on the left is a different phone company. And how they handle this is they keep dropping the data rate of the service until they get no more errors. What we did on the right here for a binder full of telephone wires that all had impulse noise was we actually changed the parameters. And there are indications of the health of the lines, even though they're dropping the data rate to try to save them. This chart here, anything big on this chart is bad. That means if you are watching television, you just lost it for about a minute every time you see a blip on this particular screen. You see, we had one here right at the beginning when we first started adapting, but otherwise these lines are clean and they're all running at 3 megabits per second. These lines in the first bunch here are 1 mile, these are 2 mile, and these are 3 mile lines to give you an idea. So again, the automated fixes can make quite a difference, and you can see four times the data rate, again, occurring on a number of the longer lines here. So that is basically politeness. That's a single line just behaving well, changing some of its parameters, but not trying to cooperate in any sense with other DSL lines. So what I'd like to do now in the second part of this talk is to talk about what could happen if they cooperate. First off, there's a couple of terms in DSL that you may see. There's something called bonding. Bonding means taking a bunch of phone lines independently and just parsing up your data signal and putting it on all of the lines to get n times the data rate if you have n lines, and then multiplexing and inverse multiplexing them. Vectoring is more sophisticated than that. It has elements of bonding in it, but it also actually cooperates at the physical layer between lines. So it's more than just n times the data rate. When could you do this? Well, when the incumbent local exchange company has a DFLAM that's at the end of the fiber, more than likely there are about 90 to 200 customers that may be served from those remote DFLAMs, and they are typically all in the same binder. And they all terminate not only on the same DFLAM, but usually on the same line card. And in fact, there are electronic distribution frames that go into these things where you can actually force them to all terminate on the same card. If you could do that, how much faster could you go? Well, here's an example that we actually ran for the German phone company in this particular case, using this cooperation versus the current systems where we actually allowed them to be polite. And they're done for different types of international band plans or regulatory bodies. In Germany, allow certain band usages. For those same situations, you see the red line basically over shorter distances out to about a kilometer, making quite a difference in terms of the data rate. Now, this is with respect to politeness. So there's another lift here that's coming from cooperation. Today, they don't even get these speeds because they're not being polite. Here's another shot of the same type of thing with much more obnoxious noises in the cable, but still the same type of improvement. So if I were to look at this and take this binder full of lines and say they actually cooperate using this vectoring, what I've done is I had the same plot I had earlier. If you actually check the numbers, you would see we were plotting data rate versus loop length in 10 megabits per second symmetric when 5,000 feet. So that's the lower curve here. This upper blue curve now adds the possibility of cooperating, basically aligning the signal. And what you can see is that 10 megabit symmetric is now going about 7,000 feet instead of 5,000 feet. And the amount of improvement is actually larger on the shorter lines. Why would that be the case? Well, when lines are shorter and we attempt to run at higher speeds, the higher the frequencies you use on a telephone line, the more it radiates. So the more crosstalk it creates into its neighbors, so you can actually see the improvement from that. This second plot over here simply goes from 9,000. It's too hard to see the difference here, so we enlarge the scale, and all the way out to the longest length there is some level of improvement that you can get from cooperation. Now, some people ask, well, where can DSL go in the future? And in particular, so-called WiMAX systems are one of the competitors on the horizon for access systems. Here is actually a picture of one from Great Britain. We're out on the telephone pole. The highest thing is usually the power company. So what's happened here is they fed power down to a WiMAX box, and then they're offering service on some experimental basis. Now, if you go out to the telephone pole and do that, that's going to be typically within 100 meters, perhaps no further than 300 meters from the actual residence. So if we could actually do that, someone could run fiber out to these points and put these kinds of boxes in. What's the data rate that you could achieve when you get within a few hundred meters of a home? And the area sometimes called gigabit DSL in this area looks at this situation where if you are running fiber out closer and closer to the so-called B-boxes or pedestals and get closer to the customer, what can happen is that typically the length is 100 meters, but usually no more than 300 meters. And if you look in your house here in the United States, you would typically find at least four twisted pairs coming into the service. They didn't all go back to the central office, but in case you wanted to have more than one phone in your house, they ran the extra copper out there, but they only connected it back to the central office if you ordered service. The fiber runs out here. There's more copper out in that segment of the network. So if you want to bond together anywhere from two to six lines, I'm going to use four in the example we look at and say, what kind of data rate can you get now if you cooperate out that far? And of course, as you might guess, because the line is shorter and we're using these same techniques, it's going to run even faster. Now, with four telephone lines, it's actually eight wires. So as long as you're going to terminate on both sides, you recognize there's actually seven channels in there with respect to a reference. So actually, you get a little bit of the gain that way if you use all of the phone lines in, as well as all of the other techniques we've talked about so far. So if I were to look at the data rates now, again, symmetric. So if we're looking at Ethernet-like speeds of 10 megabits per second earlier, what about a gigabit Ethernet type speed? Well, here's 1 gigabit per second. This blue line up here represents what we can do with the best so-called VDSL2 systems today and the use of vectoring and bonding in those systems. It's over a gigabit at least to 300 meters in this case. So one could truly offer a gigabit DSL service. Is this that surprising? Well, if you remember a Category 5 cable that you use for your gigabit Ethernet today, that will go 100, 150 meters. It would be best components that are available in that space. And there are four twisted pairs inside that Category 5 cable. So basically what's happening here is we're more than doubling the range of those Ethernet systems, just using more sophisticated processing inside the system. So gigabit DSLs are very much so feasible and possible in the not too distant horizon. So if I were to conclude then, hopefully you take away a few things from today's talk, that the possibilities for much higher speeds in DSL are there. There's a first step that's relatively easy, which amounts to essentially eliminating the hogging that goes on that's pervasive in DSL today, and there are a number of ways to be able to do that. You get a lift. Maybe 100 million DSL lines, there's a little more than that today, going to speeds as high as 10 megabits per second. If we actually cooperate and we want to get at least 100 megabits per second to everyone, and maybe over a billion users in the future, then we could do this. And finally, the last step would be those drops, running fiber about as close as you can economically run it within a few hundred meters. Some people call that fiber to the home, but it's actually fiber not quite to the home with typically a DSL system. Following that, it's possible to go as high as a gigabit per second and do that reasonably feasibly. So with that, as my talk today, I thank you again for your attention.
After lunch, we will have a panel and discuss all this stuff. But I have one question first. Asia, they're now average. In Korea, they average between 8 and 10 megabits per second across the whole country. And in Japan, they're rapidly moving up toward those rates. How do your observations relate to those achievements? If your technology is your technology used in any of those applications, or do they have a different mode of delivering this kind of bandwidth?
Some of the very earliest things that I mentioned are just starting to be used not only in Korea and Japan, but elsewhere. They have shorter phone lines in Korea and Japan, so they start from a better place. But yep. You can certainly put these techniques on those and either reduce the operational cost or take it in terms of get a higher speed at a given length of line that they're trying to achieve. So very much so, techniques being used, and we'll see more and more as newer generations of components offer more of these capabilities.
Thank you very much. Well, let's.